Morning. This morning I want to talk about freedom. Freedom is perhaps something that maybe we think we understand, and no doubt we do. We have some understanding of freedom, but in Buddhism, very often our understanding of our situation is the reverse of what we might think. The Buddha frequently spoke of this. He said, I go against the stream, the way we commonly go. He goes in a different way, draws our mind in a different way. He said that what I call liberation, the world calls resignation. Actually, what he said is what the world calls resignation, I call liberation or freedom. And of course, we're speaking of freedom of mind. This is where we actually find freedom, is freedom in the mind or of the mind. Of course, physically, if we're put in bondage, in jail, we say this isn't freedom. But if our mind is free, this is much less of a bondage than we might otherwise think. But what is it that the Buddha is speaking of? What I call liberation, the world calls resignation. I want to look at that a little bit today. Really what I want to look at is how it is that we get this backwards. And as a result, we feel ourselves in bondage. We feel ourselves trapped in some way. We're confused. We don't know what's going on. We're always running towards something, away from something else. This is not freedom. This is confusion, this is pain, this is suffering, this is dukkha. This is the very heart of what the Buddha's teaching is all about. How is it that we're so confused on this? In the 46th case of the Blue Cliff Record, I've used this story, I've talked on this before, where the teacher said that human beings are inverted. They lose themselves, he said, and chase after things. So there's many references we find in Zen literature, in Buddhist literature in general, that refer to this fact that somehow we have it backwards. We're confused over this issue. What we think is liberating is actually bondage. What we think is bondage is actually liberation. Or perhaps what we think is resignation, just resigning ourselves to something, is liberation. I've talked on that particular topic before about resignation and liberation, and so I'm not going to say much about that today. But Buddhism isn't about resignation. It is about freedom. And this freedom of mind comes through knowing, through seeing what is going on, as opposed to getting caught up in our ideas and thought about what is going on. And I think one example that might really illustrate how it is that we're confused is this song of Milarepa. So I like to think of it as the song of the solitary, Song of Milarepa. So I want to read this poem and talk about it a little bit. When we're confused in the way that the Buddha points out, this story, this poem here, will probably strike us as being very bleak, very dark, very sad. If we are free in our mind and we understand this freedom that the Buddha is speaking of, this poem is liberation. It is light. It is airy. It is complete freedom. But we tend not to see it this way. We tend to see this as kind of gloomy, very sad. Milarepa had a very difficult life, as he describes here briefly. And we get caught up in Buddhism itself very often, because it is not easily understood when we first approach it. Oftentimes people have the impression of Buddhism as kind of gloomy, dark, always looking on the somber side of things, talk about suffering and this sort of thing. But the point of Buddhism is freedom from suffering, freedom from dukkha. It is not to dwell in it. It is basically to see what it is. And so it needs to be pointed out, so we point right to it. So in reading this poem now, I'll just read it through first and then we'll take a look at it. But you might very well have the impression this is pretty sad. This is pretty bleak. But I can show you, I'm going to try to show you how this is actually pointing to great freedom, complete and total freedom. It's a song of Milarepa. Perhaps I should say a little bit about Milarepa. He's a great saint in the Tibetan system and one of their great teachers. He, as you see here, his father died when he was 7 years old. And then he went through great difficulties and hardships of various kinds. And eventually he went off and trained with, well, at first he trained with a teacher who then sent him to Marpa, his great teacher, who put him through all kinds of extreme practices. Talk about a teacher being hard on their students. I mean, this is probably the ultimate case. I won't go into all the things that Marpa dished out for Milarepa, but it was very difficult. 9 years of practice to the point where Milarepa was at the edge of despair, edge of suicide. And then Marpa began to show him liberation, freedom through meditation. Eventually Milarepa went off and practiced in solitude for 9 years in an icy cave in the high up in the Himalayas. And only then did he emerge as a teacher, and he began to teach. And he's one of the Tibetan system's greatest teachers. Even today, his story is very inspiring. But again, if we look at this superficially, this is going to look rather sad, perhaps. But see if you can see the great freedom that is in it. The Song of Milarepa, he said, "All phenomena existing and apparent are ever transient, changing and unstable. But more especially, the worldly life hath no reality, no permanent gain. And so instead of doing work that's frivolous, the truth unbound I'll seek. When the father died, the son lived not. Now that I am born, my father does not live. Had both together met, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. When the mother lived, the son was long away. Now that I've returned, my mother no longer lives. Had both together met, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. When the sister was at home, her brother was away. Now that I've returned, my sister has gone astray. Had both together met, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. When the Dharma texts were there, they had no veneration. Now that I venerate them, they lay damaged by the rain. Had both together met, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. When the house stood firm, the master was away. Now that the master has returned, the house is fallen in ruin. Had both remained together, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. When the field was fertile, the farmer was away. Now that the farmer has returned, the field is choked with weeds. Had both remained together, little would have been the merit even then. So I will realize the truth unbound. To the Drakkar Tassal cave I'll go, to practice meditation. Native land and home and all possessions are all without true benefit. Any thoughtless one may have you. As for me, a solitary, I go to realize the truth eternal." Well, that's the song of Milarepa, coming right out of his life, out of his heart, out of his deep desire to get to the truth. And he isn't about to settle for anything less. And this, perhaps, as I said, it might sound a little bleak, but it is actually pointing to liberation, to freedom. And again, our confusion in this is really critical. We see this again and again in Buddhist teachings, that what we take to be bright light is dark and murky. What we take for liberation is actually bondage. the bondage we seek to avoid, it looks something like this perhaps, we don't realize is actually a liberation. So if you wonder why you can live out your life and never really taste true freedom, consider the fact that we're always seeing it reversed from how it actually is. And very often too, another example that we get in Buddhism and Zen, where the teacher, sometimes in this teaching, if it's handled in poorly, the teacher doesn't understand quite what they're doing. They don't realize this true freedom. And they're very apt to hand you things, to give you things that you can grasp, take hold of, and you'll be very appreciative of that. You'll want that. You'll try to take hold of that which you can easily grasp. It feels good. There seems to be maybe some freedom in it, some learning, some understanding. It comes quite quickly, easily. But then you walk away and it goes on. It's the same thing. What is this? What is this all about? And we think somehow that we're going to get it like that, like it's going to come to us from outside. It is something out there that we need to have, some enlightenment, some freedom, some understanding. It has to come from out there. And we're looking at this completely backwards. This goes to the heart of what the Buddha is teaching. We're seeing this in a completely backward way. And as a result, that which points to freedom, we see it as a kind of bondage, or perhaps resignation, giving up, throwing in the towel. We don't see it as actual freedom. And where we seek freedom, joy, peace, happiness, it is just the opposite of that. Well, let's take a look at this. If this did strike you as being a little bleak, let's just take a look. Because superficially it does. It does look quite bleak. It's very sad. Very sad poem. Unless we actually see it. He starts out saying, all phenomena, everything that we find here is, he said, existing and apparent. Existing, that which appears to be moving on from moment to moment. It was with us yesterday, it is here again today, it will be here tomorrow. But of course, it can perish, it can die. Other things that I want to be here to exist, I want to bring them about, I want them to be created for me. But this is how we look at phenomena, this is how we see it. All phenomena is existing and apparent. That's how it is. It appears to exist, and it appears. It shows up as something. In some capacity, as some object, some idea, some thought, some belief, something. And something perhaps graspable, if not by the hand, then at least by the mind. This is phenomena. And he's saying that all phenomena are transient, changing, and unstable. But because we're already presuming some kind of a permanence there, we're seeing permanence where there actually isn't any. Now we see this thing that we would reach for as impermanent. We see it as unstable. We see it as changing. And we are very much disturbed by that. But because we're fooled by the idea of permanence, seeing somehow permanence behind what is only impermanent, we'll continue to grasp, continue to reach for, continue to look for something. But he's saying all phenomena existing and apparent are ever transient, changing, and unstable. So changing, so unstable that there is actually nothing there. That the phenomena itself is just a wash of appearance, that there's actually nothing behind it at all. But he says, more especially, the worldly life hath no reality, no permanent gain. There's nothing here that we can take hold of that is actually going to do it for us. Only temporarily, momentarily. And if we understand that, that's fine. But we continue to look for that which is going to ultimately satisfy us. In what is ever transient, stable, unpermanent, changing, and it is very dissatisfying to us. This is where that sense of dissatisfaction is coming through. And when we don't understand ultimately what this means, this total thoroughgoing change and flux, then this poem strikes us as being sad, as being kind of bleak and dark, that life has no meaning, etc. But this is only occurring in our mind because we think behind the phenomena somewhere there is something that is permanent. We're confused by that. We're still looking for that. We're looking for our enlightenment as some permanent thing that we can grasp and take hold of. But we're always looking in the wrong place. We're always looking to phenomena. This is the worldly life. But it has no reality, no permanent gain. And so Milarepa became quite clear on this point. And so he said, instead of doing work that's frivolous, it isn't going to go anywhere. It's kind of trivial, beside the point, doesn't get down to it. Instead of doing this, instead of looking at the phenomenal world, the usual stuff that we look to, for some kind of understanding, some peace of mind, some realization, instead of doing this, he said, it's the truth unbound, the truth that I cannot grasp, the truth that I cannot take hold of in some way. It is the truth unbound I'll seek. I'll turn my eyes to that. And that is what he's describing here. And then he goes through this long description of his experiences in life. His father died when he was young. His mother, when he was on his different escapades, looking for something to give him peace, quiet his mind. There's a bit of a story there, but I can't take the time this morning to get into that. But for some time he's away. When he comes back, he finds the bones of his mother in a ruined house. The house had fallen into ruin, and his sister has gone. And the Dharma texts, there was a temple there. The teachings of the awakened were there in this place. That had all fallen in, and the rain had gotten into these different books. He said when he was younger, he didn't venerate them. He didn't appreciate them. He didn't understand what they were. Now, when he has some appreciation for these things, he comes back and finds them damaged. And again, the house, too, he finds it in ruin. And the field where they were farmers, and the field now has overgrown. But with each one of these things that he makes, these observations he makes, he said that had both together met, had it been different, had my father lived, had I not ventured far, stayed nearby with my mother and sister, had I learned to appreciate these books and venerate them early on in life, and had we kept the farm and the house and all of that, what he's saying is that even if it had gone that way, he said, had both together met, little would have been the merit, even then. Because what he realizes now is that these things, while they might comfort us in small ways throughout our life, these are not bad things. These are not things that we should shun or do away with, home and family and all of that. It is not that. But there is nothing in that, there's nothing about that, that is going to bring us to the truth. The way we find the truth, the way we awaken, the way we see what is going on here is working independent of all of these things. And in fact, it is quite possible that to the extent it is all going so very well for us, we are not motivated to look for the truth, but we are more seduced into thinking that somehow we can find comfort and peace through this phenomenal existence where there's no reality or permanent gain. But we don't see that, and so we're more likely to be caught up in that way. So this is what he's saying here, is that even if all these things had worked out well for him, these worldly kinds of things, a little would have been the merit. And merit, I've talked about this word before, what are we speaking of here? Merit is that which is occurring in your life, which is helpful, conducive to your awakening, to waking up to what is actually taking place. We call this merit. And it isn't like, as mentioned before, it isn't like getting your merit badge and sculpture. It's not like getting points or anything. It is a matter of just simply there are certain things, there are certain ways approaching life that will turn our attention to the truth, to reality. And there are other things that will lull us into a kind of a stupor, into a blindness, where we, into a quiet complacency, where we don't really realize that we have this deep problem of human existence, and we need to understand it. We need to find out what that is. Otherwise, we will be left in a kind of torment. Sometimes the torment is very close to the surface, and we realize it. Very often, the torment is so deeply buried in all of these worldly affairs that we don't really realize that it is there. But Milarepa is certainly aware of this, and he realizes that even if you can get all the worldly affairs in order and everything is working smoothly, this is not, because this isn't the territory in which we look. We don't look to the phenomenal existence if we want to understand the deep nature of reality itself. He says, I will realize the truth unbound. He realizes that what he's looking for is not something that is bound. In other words, it has a surface, it has a limit, it has some defining characteristics. It is the truth, reality itself. He already realizes that this is something that isn't going to show up like an ordinary object of any kind whatsoever. Object, whether it's thought, a thought object, or an object we can see and touch. He already realizes this. He's looking for the truth unbound, something that he isn't going to take hold of as some idea or thought or belief or object or practice even, or wearing of special robes or doing any kind of ceremony. Here he says, like even the Dharma text, the teachings of the awakened, even if he had learned to appreciate this early on, even that isn't enough to do this. Because it is just another teaching, it is just another religion, it is just another belief or way of doing things. And perhaps there's ways of dressing and behaving and carrying on that are connected with this. None of this is going to do it. And of course, there's no leaving of these ordinary kinds of activities, because no matter what we do, we are moving, we are dressing, we are speaking, we are acting in particular ways. So it's not found in that, and yet at the same time we cannot leave that. We need to do something else. And so he says to the Dragkar Tassal cave, I'll go to practice meditation. And even this idea of meditation, it takes us a long time, I think, in Zen really to begin to appreciate and to understand just what meditation is. Part of our problem is that we just assume that we know what meditation is. We do it every day, and we've had courses in it, perhaps, in meditation instruction. And so we know what meditation is. But really, it takes some time before we really understand what meditation is. I'd been meditating, I guess, at least outwardly. It looked like I was meditating. I thought I was meditating for many years, actually, before I began to realize what this is. And it wasn't until I met a good teacher that kept drawing my attention. He'd say peculiar things about meditation, as Katagiri Roshi I'm speaking of, that really threw me. And what is he talking about? And is he just trying to be clever, silly, creative? No, he was always pointing to just what it is. And we deceive ourselves in very many ways. This is something I brought up, I guess, in the Monday night class, but I think I should speak on it here about the notion of meditation, because I think it's one of the, it's probably the biggest trap snare that we lay for ourselves in terms of understanding meditation, is just in the way that we speak of it. And I'm guilty of this too. In fact, I probably taught a lot of you to speak of meditation in this way. But we call it sitting. So we think that meditation has something to do with sitting. You know, and I call it sitting. We talk about sitting. But in a subtle way, this is very misleading, because it reinforces in our minds in all kinds of subtle ways that what meditation is has something to do with sitting. And we'll think this. We'll even read where Dogen Zenji says that Zazen, and he calls it Sanzen in the Fukan Zengi, but that's Zazen. He says Zazen has nothing to do with sitting or lying down. And we'll read that. And in fact, those who come for the Friday night meditation, we always recite that at the end of the meditation on Friday nights. We'll read that and we'll read it over and over again, and yet we'll go on thinking that Zazen is sitting. Because we use the term sitting, you know, when we speak of Zazen very often. Well, I was thinking, that's all right, I suppose we'll just continue to do that. It's not really bad or wrong. But it isn't that we're sitting. That isn't the point. The point isn't that we're sitting. What is meditation? Meditation is collecting your mind. Collecting your mind. Doesn't mean you have to carry your zafu with you wherever you go. Driving a car, you can be collecting your mind. You're conversing with a friend, or you're preparing an apple pie or something. Writing a letter. It doesn't matter what the activity. If we really understand the meditation, this meditation, if we really understand it, the state of mind that we're speaking of can reach into every activity of your life. I have yet to master this. I've been engaged in a practice of meditation now for over 30 years. I have yet to master meditation, but that's what it is. So that you will have that Zazen mind, that meditation mind, that mind of awakening, attentiveness, being right there all the time with what you are doing. And I don't think the point is that we get there 24/7. Don't worry about that. Never mind that. Just keep bringing yourself back whenever you can. Of course, this activity that we do when we sit. Well, what is that? Well, we, just like, you know, you want to play the piano, you want to learn to practice the piano, well, maybe you need to get in there and run your scales once in a while and do a few things like that. Sort of practice. And that's what we call it, practice. So you get used to focusing the mind in that way. Well, what are we doing there? Well, when you're writing a letter, there's a lot of distraction. You're on the phone, there's a lot of distraction. You're doing all these different things, making a cake or whatever. There's a lot of distraction there. Easy for the mind to become uncollected, to disperse. Meditation is just collecting the mind, bringing it back to this moment. So it's very helpful for us to limit our activity periodically. Just really limit it so we're actually not engaged in anything. We don't have to think about anything. Of course, we will be thinking. The mind, you know that. The mind just keeps popping up stuff. But maybe ultimately we can learn that we don't have to do that if we're not engaged in any particular activity. And this is the activity of now formally sitting in meditation. And we call that sitting. But then we think that somehow it's the sitting that is the meditation. No, it is the collecting of the mind. It is what we are doing with our mind. And we shouldn't lose sight of this. Otherwise, we don't understand what the activity is that we do. And it is very, very good that we, periodically, and I would say on a regular basis, whether it's daily or three times a week or whatever it is, but on a regular basis, you have a deliberate time set aside for this activity, to limit your activity, to sit in an alert posture, and to focus the mind, to collect the mind, to realize, to observe your mind as it goes chasing away. But we should not confuse that with the idea that somehow meditation is just simply by, sitting. Because you can be sitting and your mind is spinning all over the place. And of course, that isn't Zazen at all. On the other hand, you might be chopping a carrot or something and perfect Zazen mind right there. Here's your Zazen, chopping the carrot. The person chopping the carrot is in Zazen. The one sitting on the cushion, I don't know what they're doing. But it looks like they're the one that's doing the Zazen, but no. But, we call that sitting, see. No. So Zazen, we could say, is chopping. Yeah. Did you do any chopping today? We could say, But, of course, that seems kind of silly. Well, it's equally as silly to single out the sitting. The only reason it is maybe special in that way is because we do it intentionally, deliberately, and we have limited our activity. But this is very important, I think, to understand what this practice is. And it takes us a long time to appreciate, even after it's pointed out to us in various ways. It takes a long time for us to really digest this and to get it into our system that this is what we're doing. This is what we're doing. And it isn't limited to the Zendo. This is something we can learn to bring our mind back to repeatedly. Eventually we can find this centered, focused mind in any activity that we are doing. So here he says, I will realize the truth unbound. To the drag cart, toss out cave, I'll go. To practice meditation, he says. And this is what he's going there. Not to sit, no doubt he sat, but to collect the mind, to realize what the mind is doing. And this drag cart, toss out cave is that he's going to do it alone. He's going to do this in solitude. And it doesn't matter whether you're sitting with others. Here's another way that we get things reversed. When we are alone, when we are truly alone, we don't realize that we're alone. And we don't realize what the activity of being alone is, or the activity of the solitary. And then we start getting caught up in everybody else's business, thinking about them and what they're doing, what they're saying, what they're thinking. When that is the place where we have our own activity to do, this is the place where we can be alone with reality, with the truth itself, the truth unbound. But we don't go there. We're very busy outwardly looking at them, at others, in various ways, in regards to me. And we also judge them, etc. The mind is very often working in this place. This is the place where we reverse it. And where we do need to attend to them out there is in our practice, here is in meditation, also in considering others, in the fact that we are sitting with others, we're living with others on this planet. We are considering the needs of others in terms of how we make use of this planet, how we make use of this building, how we enter a room. All of these kinds of things where we tend to now be focused just on ourselves and what we're doing. We're not paying any attention to others. Whatever it is we want to extract from the earth, we'll extract that, and we won't pay any attention to how this is affecting others, other beings, other economies, other whatever it is. We've become very focused, very myopic, very narrow in our vision. And of course, it is always putting ourselves in that spot. We have it reversed. This is the place where we need to be social. We need to be open. We need to be aware that our life is actually extended. It is inseparable from the lives of all others. So there is one more area where we tend to reverse these two kinds of activities. Where we are attending to others, this is where we should be attending to our own mind. And where we disregard others, this is where we need to be considering others. But this is one more thing I think that we can learn through this practice of meditation. And going to this Dwarkar Tassal cave, though, is signaling that this is the activity of the solitary. This is something you're going to do alone. No one else can do this for you. No one else can attend to your mind. You need to do this. This is your territory, your job. But one of the reasons we tend not to understand, again, the practice of meditation is because this is the place where we're very prone to minding everybody else's business in that very area where we really ought to be attending to our own. So this is what this Dwarkar Tassal cave is signaling to us. And then he ends it with native land and home and all possessions. And his family, home, all possessions. They're all without true benefit, the benefit of they will not supply us with awakening to the truth. In another, there's nothing in there that we can grasp, take hold of, preserve, that will give us the truth. And he said, any thoughtless one may have you. Anyone who is not attending to what is taking place, we're not considering this, we're not considering how we're conducting our lives, how we're actually living here, how we're engaged with each other, and how it is that we are alone, how it is that we are together. We're thoughtless. We're not giving any attention to this at all. And anyone can, any thoughtless one can have you, any thoughtless one can get caught up in all of that out there. He said, as for me, a solitary, knowing that the only way to the truth is to you, this is your business, this is precisely where your job is. He says, I go to realize the truth eternal, the truth that is outside of time, that has nothing to do with time, the truth that is ever, ever present, ever here. We go to that alone. All the things that we do alone, you know, it's like we think we're born alone, we die alone. We live within our own opinions and thoughts, etc. Well, yeah, that's kind of an appearance, but how is it that we are truly alone? This immediate direct experience is one of a solitary, and it is alone, but it is alone as the universe is alone. It is, you know, you are inseparable from all of reality. And it's when we have a mind that sees in this way that we actually see the nature of reality and truth. So anyway, that's the song of the solitary, the song of Milarepa. Do you have any questions or comments on that?
A common basis approach to enlightenment is a kind of phenomenon.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah.
Or is it
No. And that shows how we're reversed, we're inverted, we're backwards. And we're treating enlightenment, awakening, truth, reality, the Dharma, as an object. In the very moment we are thinking in these terms, we are also solidifying ourselves as a subject, as an ego. And this is our problem. And it is very helpful for us to, first of all, to acquaint ourselves with what it is that I'm trying to point out this morning, and I think that this kind of illustrates some of those points. But we have to acquaint ourselves with that. We have to digest it and learn to recognize when it is that we're to catch ourselves, when we're reversing it. We're taking it in a backward way. Now, this is what I was saying. It took me many years to understand what this practice of meditation is all about, because of meditation, if you're going to do meditation, you have to be going
in a forward way, not this backward way. Or we could say a backward way. Dogen talks about the backward step. It's all kind of relative, I suppose. But it takes some time for us to appreciate this. I approached meditation for many years before I met Katagiri in a very ordinary way, you know. So I understand that. And it's probably where most, if not all of you, in fact, are coming from. But at some point, and I'll remind you of this in various ways, to realize that you're probably taking it in a reverse way. Just stay with it. Look at that. Notice that this is what you're doing. See if you can throw this around, turn this around. So in other words, you're not doing the meditation to get anything from the meditation. The meditation itself is just, you know, stepping into the meditation is it. It is being present, being here with. You know, Dogen Zenji calls this practice realization, which, you know, again, all of these things are dangerous. They have traps and snares. But very often with this practice realization, practice enlightenment, then people think, well, if I just sit Zazen, again, confusing all the sitting with Zazen, then that means I'm enlightened. A lot of people take Dogen as teaching that. Well, that's ridiculous. He's not talking about sitting. So you can get into, and when I was in Japan, in fact, I met people who were actually confused on this point, and thinking that to the extent that you could wear your robes properly, get into just precise, you know, of course, now, a lot of this might depend on the fact that you never broke a leg in your life and all of this, you know, so you don't have a limp. But if you could just carry yourself perfectly, you know, wear your robes just right, that somehow you're exhibiting in the enlightened mind. It's a complete perversion of what it is that Dogen was actually teaching when he talks about practice and enlightenment. So that's a great danger. So the idea is that if we can look good in our meditation, then we got it. You know, when in fact, when we've got it in our meditation, so to speak, it doesn't look like anything in particular. It might not even look like sitting in a cross-legged position. It might be chopping a carrot or something else. So, you know, this is a very important, and what Dogen is speaking when he talks of practice enlightenment, in case you run into this, and you might if you, you probably will if you read any Dogen, he's not saying that if you can physically carry this out perfectly, then now you're enlightened. It means that if you actually have this state of mind that is engaged in the activity of the moment, whatever it happens to be, whether it's sitting or doing something else, this is awakening, this is enlightenment, yes. But it is that engagement of the mind, it is that collectedness of the mind that is being here. And realization is an understanding, realizing that this is what you're doing. And either you've found this mind in this moment or not. So I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm making that clear, but this is it's a very, very subtle point. And it is something probably that we can only come to slowly. But once you begin to taste this and to realize this, and you understand what this practice, this activity, this meditation is that we're doing, you're not doing it for gain, you're not doing it because you're actually, forget what you're going to get, just see if you can actually do it. See if you can actually step into that activity and do it. Like I said, this is something you can do 24/7, never mind if you can do it 24/7, just see if you can even do it. And then maybe you can learn to do it more. Now, Jay.
Maybe when you are meditating, once you're observing your mind, what's going on, it's clear in my own case, you become very aware of how much the ego or self is attached to all your thought process. Mm-hmm. And you're letting go of that self and ego, not in a very non-judgmental way. And I notice when I take my practice outside of sitting Zazen, that's very helpful, that non-judgmental concept, and letting go of the self. And that's what I've been practicing, but I also, which is very confusing to me, is the concept of enlightenment, that moment where everything that you see of the world in a totally connected, and it's a non-intellectual event, as you describe it. If you just practice non-judgmental, and letting go of the self on a day-to-day basis, is it necessary to experience that enlightenment truth that people talk about? Is letting go of the self?
This practicing of letting go of the self, is probably too much. In other words, you can't actively do that. It has to drop off of its own. How does this occur? This occurs from actually seeing what's taking place. In other words, noticing yourself grasping. At some point, you won't grasp. But it isn't like we force ourselves to release our hand, to open our hand. Or like we intend to do that, or we try. It's like trying to fall asleep, but you can't try. It's not something you can try to do. Or you can just be aware of what it is that you are doing, and then just not be bothered by that. You know, to remind yourself that this is not a problem. And it's sort of something like that, to realize your grasping mind, to see the grasping mind, and to not grasp that. Like, oh gosh, I don't want a grasping mind, you know. Just, you know, that's still a grasping mind. Just keep looking at that and looking at that. And at some point, when you really see that and digest that, you won't be grasping. The self is now dropped away. But there's no way that you can say, I'm going to put myself aside. You keep pulling up the self to do that, and it doesn't really work. I think we can probably kind of wind it down to some degree in that process, but we can't ultimately let it drop away. But that actual dropping away of self, this is awakening, yeah. When you say, do you need to do it? You know, I don't know if it's a matter of need to, but that's what it is. So I don't know, did it help you, Jay?
Very much so.
And the other thing, just appreciate just how subtle all of this is. It's very, very subtle. And as we sit in meditation, gradually too, we'll become more and more attuned to the subtleties and the play of the mind. And don't be disturbed by that, you know, but just let it get quieter and quieter and quieter and see if you can just stay with it as it gets quieter and quieter. At some point, this grasping mind drops away. And if it really drops away, at some point, maybe not right away, but there'll be an awful lot of understanding, realization of about the nature of what's going on here that'll come to us after that. Tom.
It seems to be lots of contradictions of masters that say what they did, for instance, though they said you don't have to travel anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he went to China.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting in meditation, different. Of course, we know the Buddha sat on the Bodhi tree for a long time. Sitting in meditation are different, not necessarily the same. But then here we have a person who goes to the cave and isolates
mm-hmm.
to sit.
Mm-hmm.
Meditate. So, I guess, in some senses, you know, there's no disagreement in my mind that sitting in meditation, or you can sit in Zazen and exactly not meditate at all. Mm-hmm. Experience it many times.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe the training of the mind so you can see requires discipline.
Absolutely.
And you can't take it into everyday life. And maybe you do have to travel somewhere. Also, that came into my mind was that sitting in a cave alone, if you're truly meditating, or truly inside that, and you're not alone, because the self is not there. So, when you can be in everyday activity, in everyday life, and be truly alone, you feel isolated, you feel self, and you know, so it doesn't matter if you're in a cave or anywhere like.
Yeah, but what I was trying to say here is don't get caught up with the literal idea of the cave. That this cave is, as I said, this is indicating that he's talking about the solitary activity and making it, you know, your own in the way that I described, because there's only you that can do this. I can't do it for you, other people can't do it for you. So this is what is meant by the cave. Now, literally, does it mean go into a cave? Did he go into a cave? I don't care about those parts of it. We can get caught up in that. But in a sense, it is like going into a cave alone by yourself, in a sense. But to say that this is required, you must do this, you know, or you have to go somewhere, you have to go to Tibet, or well, I went to Japan, I went to France with Thich Nhat Hanh, but do you have to do it? No, you don't have to do that. I've done it, so I can tell you don't have to, but if you feel like it, go ahead. I'm not going to stop you. Because if that's just going to keep itching in the back of your mind, well then maybe you better go. What I really want to point out here is the subtlety with which we grasp. And we need to observe this. We need to see this. And even in the story of the cave, was it a cave or is it not a cave, or what does a cave mean? You know, and all of this, The point is to realize what it is that you're doing. This is all we really need to do. And we need to realize what it is that only you can do. And we also need to realize that area, that territory of your life that isn't yours. It is the life of the world. We need to realize this as well. And we also need to realize how in that world we're always grasping, reaching for that, you know, running from that. How in that world we see ourselves as apart and separate. Now we find loneliness and aloneness. But this is showing up when there's other people. This other thing, which sounds so alone and so icy and cold, like in a cave all alone by itself, is actually quite warm. But it is really attending to what it is that you need to do. So again and again, it's reversed, reversed, reversed. And be careful as you're reading this and looking at this. Notice, you can ask yourself, am I taking this in reverse order? Because in regards to enlightenment, you probably are. Because we do it over and over and over again. Human beings are inverted. They lose themselves and chase after things. And it's a very good meditation for us to come back to noticing how it is that we have it upside down and backwards and inside out. And we do this again and again and again.
Not to sit inside them. You know, if you drop that, but the discipline to want to be awake, to want to discover. And it's so easy to lose that discipline and desire when you go out into everyday life.
Yeah.
And so you have to come back to that.
Well, there are, yeah, I think you hit the, yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. That's what they had, the desire to be awake. But it has to be an honest one and a serious one. And somewhere along the line, it has to be, I will pursue that, which, even if it appears like my discomfort, because I can guarantee you, your discomfort is going to be met. You're going to find that. You're going to run into that somewhere along the line. But of course, you can get free of that, because you realize that whatever it was you thought was comfort is actually torment anyway. It helps maybe if that's pointed out to you, but until you actually realize that, it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good. But what I'm saying is that in these guys that you're speaking of, these great teachers, they had this desire to get to the truth first, above all, and nothing else was going to, you know, step in the way. And that is what they all had. They all had that, and that's what they had. That's what they had in common. And that's all that's required. But we have to realize what that is. Very often we think, well, yeah, I want to be enlightened. Yeah, I want a new job. Yeah, I want to be enlightened too. We want a lot of different things. But at some point, if you really want to wake up, that has to be, even for a moment, that has to be completely what it is you intend to do. And that involves really noticing, this is almost all exclusively what it is noticing how you're caught, noticing how you're grasping, realizing that the thing that you want cannot be grasped. And also try to remember that it doesn't need to be, so don't worry about that aspect of it. And stay on that point, but notice how, you know, even in the meditation, what you're reaching for in the meditation. If in your meditation you're reaching, if this is what brings you to the cushion is because you're going to get something, realize that that's the wrong attitude. I mean, it's not wrong. It's just an attitude that will keep you suspended in this bondage. It is bondage, right on the face of it. But when you recognize that, you won't have that attitude anymore. And now you can actually continue to sit. In fact, you can actually start sitting now, understanding what it is you're doing. But yeah, you hit that's the point. That's the salient point there that we shouldn't lose sight of. That it is this desire to awaken. But it can't be a desire to awaken for some mundane reason. That leaves us in the mundane. You know, because the desire to awaken appears in the mundane world as well. But it has to appear in a pure world, in a pure mind. For no motive, for no other reason. And if we find that is being awake already. Again, What to look for? Look for how. Look for that grasping mind. See it for what it is. And if you really see it, the grasping stops. Appreciate just how subtle all of this is. It's unbelievably subtle. But thank you very much.